Hi, I'm Tim Gerson.
And hi, I'm Will Leach, and this is the Gerson's Podcast, episode 178. Every once in a while, Gerson, I'll look at the number of our episodes. I'll be like, Jesus Christ, we've done a lot of episodes. This is one of those days.
I think my parents feel that way, too.
Yeah, my parents feel that way. Yeah, every time my parents look at me like, oh my God, you've been alive for so long.
still living, huh?
We had so many opportunities, and now look what's happened. Anyway, I don't have a lot of banter prepared, except to say this. You know, our friends, our friend Terry Ariano, who does the Extra Hot Great podcast. This week, I'm a guest on that episode next week, talking about the smartest guys in the room, the Showtime show. And one of the things about that podcast is you have to go on and give an episode for the canon, which is a Hall of Fame for television episodes. So you have to pick an episode. So I've done some pretty awesome things. Like I got one Louis episode inducted into the canon, feeling great about that these days. And so I've been on it before, and I've always been pretty good about getting shows in the canon. This year, I thought I'd like throw them a curveball and do the one that they hadn't done before, breaking our rules a little bit because they count OJ Made America as a television show while we count it as a movie. I decided episode 5 of that would be it. So I am watching OJ Made in America again, start to finish, for the first time since it came out. I gotta say, man, it's still great. B, it's just another reminder that everything now feels like it's about Trump. In all seriousness, like every single time they talk about his ego and how he wants to get away from it with everything, and he's accountable to no one. I'm just like, oh my God, like this. Even the stuff that I love that has nothing to do with Trump feels like freaking Trump stuff now.
Well, that's the interesting question, isn't it? Because in some ways, I think we've now been beaten down and conditioned to be like, oh, he's just like Trump. And it's almost like, no, actually, it turns out there are a lot of people who have
like
similar,
right.
Yeah, similar right. Narcissistic things. And I almost don't want to give Trump credit for being like, and I put this word very much in quotes, the best at being that type of horrible person.
Right,
you know?
Right,
but it's
right.
Interesting that it's like I almost don't want to give him like the credit for that. Like, no, OJ is his own terrible person.
Yeah.
It's funny that you mentioned OJ Made in America because depending on when you listen to this podcast, happy 4th of July, everyone, by the way. But they've been replaying it on ESPN mm-hmm. recently.
I wrote about him in New York Magazine last week.
And it's funny that like it's like, oh, right, he's on Twitter. How can we capitalize on this? Let's show the movie on ESPN again. Yes.
Happy 4th. Go America. Go America. Now an OJ dude is president. That's nice. Still, this is the Gerson Leach Podcast, episode 178. Remind you, as always, follow us on Twitter at Gerson Leach. Email us, GersonLeach@gmail.com. Go to our website, GersonLeach.com. Go to GersonLeach.com/RSVP. So this is the every single movie we've talked about on this here podcast. Hey, you can subscribe to us, by the way. We have an opening song. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Email us, Gerson Leach. Subscribe to us, iTunes. Opening song, Dylan Mayer on Cuthbert Avenue. Bandcamp and SoundCloud. Closing song.
Most of those words were in the correct order.
Yes. A little glitch in the matrix there. Closing song, My Friend Mary. Short songs and melancholy longs. Facebook page of My Friend Mary. We have a t-shirt, Gerson. Where do people get the t-shirt?
That's cottonbureau.com.
Cottonbureau.com. Should I let people know who the opening song and closing song is again?
That was my. Do you think Dylan Mayer every week goes, Dylan?
Here it comes.
Mayer.
Here it comes. Dylan. Here it comes. Here it comes. He's going to do it.
He's only had 178 opportunities to do this.
About 103.
That's right. We did not start with Dylan.
Anyway, subscribe to us on Google Play, Stitcher, Overcast, SoundCloud, Spotify, iHeartRadio. But the best way to find every podcast is to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts/iTunes. While you're there, give us a review, 5 stars if you could. And while you're doing that, give us a name of a movie you would like us to discuss in our reboot section, and we will discuss it. We do have a reboot movie this week, and I actually have the reviews. So thank you, Dude 88753, for not deleting your account since you gave us this review.
So is this a dude robot?
Find out. There's only one way to find out. Let's see. Let's run the Turing test on this review and see if he passes. Great listen. 5 stars, says Dude 88753 from, again, pre-Trump, June 20, 2016. So I assume this person has now gone radical and is now quit his job and joined the parade of our, or maybe he's a Bernie bro. Who knows? Anyway, the point is, Love reading and listening to Will and Tim's reviews. Smart but not cocky, fun and engaging with great rapport between the two. And the only blemish is that I wish they were still at Deadspin. If I may interject for a moment, you would not want that, dude, 88753, because then you would not be able to hear Drew McGarry say why all the Oscar movies sucks, even though he have not seen them. Hope they have a chance to go back and review Ocean's 11, 2001. So Ocean's 11 is there, the movie we're going to talk about this week, Grierson. Ocean's 11. Okay, so now we go to our first new movie this week. We got two new movies.
We have two big ones, I'd say.
So our first new movie this week is Spider-Man: Hyphen Man. That's what we know. The cinematic universe has completely run out of people. It's Hyphen Man. He just connects to much better, more interesting superheroes.
Right. He helps connect words and sentences. So those words are right.
Yeah.
That's what you come to this podcast for, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah.
Grammar jokes.
Grammar jokes. Okay. So anyway, the movie is Spider-Man Far From Home.
Everywhere I go, I see his face. I just really miss him.
Yeah, I miss him too. I don't think Tony would have done what he did if he didn't know that you were going to be here after he was gone.
You going to be the next Iron Man now?
Well, no, I don't have time. I'm too busy doing your jobs.
What?
I'm kidding. Look,
keep up the good work.
Because I am going on vacation.
Spider-Man Far From Home, like Spider-Man Homecoming, is directed by John Watts, who did Cop Car. That's kind of it, right? Cop Car, the movie about a clown, I think. And then all of a sudden he was doing Spider-Man movies. It's written by Chris McKenna, Eric Summers. It is the, what number is it? 23rd film in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. But kind of the first, perhaps noteworthy, the first since the Avengers Endgame. The big, huge thing that people were still seeing at the theater last week. People are still going out to see an extra 3 minutes. This is Spider-Man Far From Home. This is the first one after that. It follows our pal Peter Parker. Or his, one of the best jokes in the movie is they don't have a name for the spider sense, so they called it his Peter Tingle, which is a good joke. I must give them love for that. This follows Peter Parker in the wake of the Avengers Endgame movie. I will say this answers one question that I had after watching Avengers Endgame, which is, wait, how do they deal with the people that were gone for 5 years? Well, it turns out they were part of the blip. They call it a blip. Amusingly, I think it's a good setting for the first movie after the Avengers Endgame because it makes high school very confusing. Some people, there's one of Peter Parker's romantic rivals 5 years ago before the blip was just like a nerdy kid, and then after the blip he's like all jacked up and good looking, which is kind of a funny way to kind of relate to the high school experience. Anyway, so basically in a world where Tony Stark, spoiler alert, has died, he and Spider-Man and Peter Parker were so close, he seems to kind of wanted to anoint him as the next Iron Man. Spider-Man, Peter Parker, does not want that necessarily. He kind of just wants to be a normal high school kid and go, as it turns out, on a school trip throughout Europe. So he wants to go do that. There's Mary Jane, played by Zendaya, who I continue to think is one of the best parts of these movies. He just wants to be a normal kid. But Nick Fury is trying to find him because there's some sort of water monster thing that's coming. The elements are coming and attacking cities. Perhaps curiously, they keep attacking the cities that Peter Parker and his high school group are on their trips to go see. He meets Mysterio. He's not actually named Mysterio. I think his name is Ben. Beck is his name, but he ends up getting called Mysterio by Peter Parker kind of accidentally, and he decides he kind of like it. He kind of maybe wants to be an Avenger and wants to help kind of join, but he is kind of a shady character as well, maybe or maybe not, who knows. He's played by Jake Gyllenhaal, and if you can't trust Jake Gyllenhaal, damn it, Grierson, who can you trust? Having this movie come in after the Avengers Endgame, on one hand, makes a little bit of sense, and that allows you, it's a lot, you know, the Spider-Man movies are always a little bit lighter, they're always a little bit sillier, they're about high school, Spider-Man is a important superhero, but in the canon of this universe, but on the whole, they're lighter, and so I think the movie starts in kind of an amusing way, where it almost kind of plays with, they have like that funny school video channel that was in the last Spider-Man movie doing a update about what's happened since the blip. That I think it's kind of funny. But I would argue that on the whole, the Avengers Endgame was such a big thing. It reminded me a lot of Jon Favreau, who, of course, is in this movie playing Happy, Tony Stark's old assistant. Well, after he directed Iron Man, they wanted him to do Iron Man 2 and then Iron Man 3. He said, I kind of have to get out of these movies now because once you've introduced the Avengers, everything is so big and everything is so massive and the world is at stake constantly. I can't just tell like a little movie. And I think that's actually part of the problem with Spider-Man Far From Home is, A, everything seems kind of silly and inconsequential in a way that I don't think benefits a character who is fun and but not necessarily has the weightier, deeper kind of the depth of feel. We don't have the depth of feeling toward him that we had, say, to Captain America or to Tony Stark and Iron Man and even Thor and the Hulk. Spider-Man is fun. Tom Holland plays him very well. But a lot of the fun of the first movie, which I liked a lot, liked more than you, Grierson, was it really felt refreshing. And it felt like, you know what, I kind of need this palate cleanser. This is fun. While still being able to have a great villain in that movie, was still able to like deliver the goods, kind of get that franchise back on track, have a fun character. It was a good palate cleanser with everything getting so dark in like the Thanos universe. Here, after that, all that stuff has happened, this can't help but feel a little inconsequential and like a little bit silly to the point, well, we'll be careful of spoilers about this podcast. There's even a couple of things that happened toward the end of the movie that are like, oh, wait, so this is barely even connected to that world at all. And I think the stakes almost feel a little bit too low in this movie. And I will say also that a lot of the fun of the first movie it doesn't quite work as well here. It feels a little shticky. I thought Jacob Batalon as Ned, his friend, was pretty funny in the first movie. Here, he has the big flashing light above his head saying, I'm going to do something funny now. And it doesn't really work. I would also argue that J.B. Smoove and Martin Starr also have the same problem. Worrisomely, this actually began to feel a little bit to me like the Amazing Spider-Man movies that didn't really work very well as either. Like them, they had a good actor in the lead, to a good actor and actress in the lead. But they all felt kind of silly. I will say that also kind of extends to the villain. I think Jake Gyllenhaal is a really good actor, and I think he kind of plays this in kind of a smart way. I just don't really feel like this villain is particularly interesting. So yeah, I will say as someone that was really much on the Spider-Man Homecoming train, it's undeniable to me. I found Far From Home kind of a surprising disappointment.
You get to stay on the podcast for now, Will.
Good. I passed.
Yeah. I saw this about a week and a half ago, and I will, I will confess. I'm like, Will better not like this. He better not fall for this one. Because you're right. You like the first one better than I did, and I like the first one. It is funny to go back. I wrote something for Mel Magazine about this movie where I actually went back and looked at the movies that Marvel put out after an Avengers movie. Not counting Captain America Civil War, which is Avengers-ish, but the other, like the four actual Avengers movies. The first one, they put out Iron Man 3 afterwards. And Iron Man 3 really kind of wrestled with what had happened at the end of The Avengers and how Iron Man felt about that. But since then, whether Age of Ultron or Infinity War, you had Ant-Man movies. And those very much felt like, these are small stakes movies. We know that they're small stakes movies. These are just kind of fun. And that's what they're supposed to be. And they know that about themselves. And on that level, that's how they're supposed to operate. I think it's interesting to have Spider-Man Far From Home after Endgame. And all the reasons you said, I think, are the problems with this movie. It is weird to have Spider-Man not in New York. I actually found myself, the joke I wanted to put in my review for Street International was like, I wanted to call this movie Spider-Man European Vacation, because it's not just the fact that, as you said, that everything is a little more shticky. I think very consciously they are making an 80s horny teens going to Europe movie. Like they're doing Euro Trip essentially, but in the guise of a Marvel movie. And that's kind of interesting because Peter Parker really likes MJ, but he's afraid to say anything. And meanwhile, his buddy Ned, there's that other girl that, they don't actually like, or they think that she's kind of snobby, but then he falls for her. So you have like these relationships happening while at the same time, Peter Parker's being recruited by Samuel L. Jackson, Nick Fury character. And so it's like he has to balance school and his relationships and this thing about like he's the superhero who's been sort of christened as kind of the new leader of the Avengers because, and this is another problem with this movie, they have to have the obligatory funny, why can't we talk to this Avenger? Because they're here. Why can't we talk to this Avenger? They're over there. They're in like this universe or this parallel reality. So conveniently, Spider-Man is the only person available to do brave stuff in this movie. The other problem is that, you know, I think that this movie wisely is in some ways a reflection of how do both Peter Parker and the Earth deal with the fact that Tony Stark is gone. Iron Man is dead. And I think some of that stuff actually works in terms of how there are these like worldwide murals in honor of not just the fact that Iron Man is dead, but that he was the one that sacrificed himself in certain ways to kill Thanos. And that this movie is very much about like, how does Peter Parker live without Tony Stark? I would argue that this movie's bigger problem is that how is Marvel going to live without Thanos? One of the things that has always held the Marvel movies together is maybe you don't like Doctor Strange as a movie. Maybe you thought Captain Marvel was just okay. Each of the individual standalone movies, you would go, well, I know that Thanos is coming, that we are building towards Thanos. So every one of the individual movies, even if you didn't love them, you could say, well, there's still that tension of, I know Thanos is on the horizon. I know we are eventually going to get to that fight. There is no Thanos anymore. And if you are going to give me, I think they're called the elementals, if you're going to give me like a fire monster and a water monster, that is insufficient. Like that is just, I'm not interested in that. And you know, in terms of spoilers or not, it becomes pretty obvious pretty quickly that those are not the bad guys in this movie and that they're in fact something else. And I would also argue that while I get that Peter Parker is a high school kid, you and I did a piece where we ranked the different Spider-Man actors. And one of the things that we talked about Tom Holland is he feels sufficiently young in a way that even like Tobey Maguire and Andrew Garfield, who were good Spider-Men, they felt older. They didn't actually seem like high school kids. Tom Holland does, and that helps. But the problem is, I think that there is something that Peter Parker does in this movie that is so irredeemably stupid that is basically passed off as, well, he's a kid and he feels overwhelmed. I don't buy it. And it actually made me go, no, I don't buy this. And it actually took me out of the movie. And those things are problems. I think some of the action sequences are pretty well done. There is still, I think, sort of a decent level of quality that all Marvel movies have. But I was actually kind of going back through it, like through the recent ones. And this is my least favorite since the first Ant-Man, which I also didn't hate, but didn't like and felt was just sort of like a placeholder. This movie feels like a placeholder pivot to what is going to come next in like the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And Kevin Feige, the producer of all of these movies, who's sort of the Marvel mastermind, his track record over the last 22 movies has been pretty good. So I give him the benefit of the doubt. But I watched this movie and thought, this is like 2 hours and 15 minutes of me sort of waiting, like running in place, waiting for what's going to happen next. And to have a Spider-Man movie that does that, it just felt kind of disappointing. And my final comment is, Martin Starr's funny. I remember that he is funny. He is not funny in this movie. He and J.B. Smoove are actually, I think, actually borderline embarrassing in this movie. And that they very much feel like they are in an 80s teen comedy, but not a good one.
Yeah, and it's funny how much, because you know, they don't actually have another movie scheduled yet, right? Like, we don't actually know when the next Marvel movie is. And ordinarily, this is, I mean, they know one is supposedly coming in May 2020, but we don't know which one, right? Like, so they've got a few things, they've got a Black Widow movie, I think there's the Eternals, there's like a few things roaming around, but we don't actually know. And this feels a little bit like, wow, I mean, remember, Spider-Man's partly owned by Sony, of course, and like they've kind of put it in that universe. But it's weird because it's now, it feels like it was time for a Spider-Man movie, but not time for a Marvel movie, if that makes a certain amount of sense. And so because of, you get this kind of weird thing that straddles both sides. I want to talk a little bit, again, we can be careful about spoilers, I suppose, but I'll put it this way. We ranked Spider-Man villains for Vulture this week, and I had not seen the movie, but I felt comfortable saying that Jake Gyllenhaal could be on that list. Is probably the best way to put it. And
maybe he is. Maybe all of us are villains in our own way.
Yeah, I mean, I'll put it this way. It would be very weird to be like, hey, Jake Gyllenhaal, come be the main person that helps out Spider-Man in this new movie. Like, and that's another problem, right? Is that there is a clear twist in this movie, but the twist is, A, it's partly telegraphed in the fact that Jake Gyllenhaal is suddenly playing this really helpful character who's just around to come be a nice fella. And and so
you see how trusting Will and I are that we immediately suspect anybody who's trying to be nice to us.
Yes, it's true. Well, if Jake Gyllenhaal suddenly shows up in my life and is like unusually helpful to me for no other reason, uh-huh. I do feel like I would be like, hey, what's up with Jake Gyllenhaal being around here all the time? Whereas if some like random person came by, I might be more trusting. My point is that the villain is, if I'll put it this way, if Jake Gyllenhaal is not the villain in this movie, then please tell me on the poster, who do you think the villain is? Because generally speaking, we know how villains are. And so because of that, it just takes a certain amount of the drama out of the movie, in that you talk about missing Thanos for the first hour of this movie. I mean, I'm basically spending a lot of time being like, okay, when does Jake Gyllenhaal turn? Like, when's he turn? Because I know he's not actually, I can't take him at face value. And it just feels, once you actually learn his plan, it's interesting and it's kind of a funny twist. It reminded me a little bit of what I would argue one of the best surprise twists in the Marvel Universe, which is Iron Man 3. Iron Man 3 has like a very, very clever kind of twist that actually plays and turns away from something in the comic books a little bit, that does something that's very funny. This is in that ballpark, but not as interesting, definitely not as surprising, and ultimately not as big of a deal, I would guess. Once you learn who he is, you're like, okay, well, if Spider-Man hadn't have done just the dumbass thing that he did, this guy would be really easy to take out. and in a world where Thanos can get rid of half the universe by snapping his fingers, that's really not quite enough, even as well as Jake Gyllenhaal does play him.
Yeah, we will get to another movie. And I don't like to compare movies in this way, but I will say, in terms of difficult plans to pull off and orchestrate that require a certain amount of the person that you are targeting doing the thing that you want them to do, a movie that we're going to talk about later in the podcast pulls it off again and again and again. In this movie, like, basically it's like, oh, we just need him to do this really stupid thing. Oh my God, he actually did it. That is what the entire movie is built around. Two other things I want to mention. I actually kind of like, what actually works, I think, in this movie is the sort of surreal, funky action sequences. There is a thing that happens in Far From Home where the fabric of reality starts to unravel. And so those fight sequences are kind of trippy and fun. And they're not exactly like they are in Doctor Strange. It's not that kind of thing exactly. But I actually kind of liked when it played with the reality in the fight scenes. I thought that was actually well done. A thing that you have not mentioned yet that I'm a little surprised by that I'm going to mention, it's not just Thanos and it's not just Iron Man being gone. Into the Spider-Verse is on Netflix now.
Yeah.
And I've had a lot of people who have not seen Into the Spider-Verse yet talk to me about it. They've been waiting to see it on Netflix. You know, my friends with young kids who are not, you know, in our business, you know, who come around to movies finally when they come to Netflix and being like, oh my God, this movie's really great. You know, they are so pleasantly surprised and sort of shocked by it. And, you know, Spider-Verse came out in December, and that is another thing that kind of weighs on this movie. I think Tom Holland is good. I agree with you. I think I continue to like Tom Holland. I like Tobey Maguire a lot, and I like Andrew Garfield a lot. I'm somewhat protective of both of them, weirdly enough. And I think they're good. And I think he is good in a different way. So I don't think it's Tom Holland's fault. And I feel like this one just more feels like, you said jokey. This one feels more like, it feels a bit, to use the common parlance, it feels a bit more like a flex in certain ways. It feels more like, hey, this is the thing we do. Let's have some fun. And that fun doesn't entirely translate. I just hope that they actually bring, I mean, it's a weird thing to say, but I do really feel this way. While he's like tooling around Europe, while in some ways it's kind of cool to see Spider-Man out of New York, it feels like Spider-Man is, of all the superheroes who are so in the place where they come from, Spider-Man seems to me, is as much as Batman in Gotham City or whatever, like, Spider-Man is New York, and to have him not in New York is novel, but I actually found it kind of weirdly unsatisfying. It makes him seem more like a generic superhero because he's grounded in a place and that kind of informs his character. Him kind of tooling around Europe is just not the same thing.
Last thing on this, before we get to the grades, I do think there is, again, I'll be careful of spoilers here. It feels like this movie wants to, in a kind of haphazard way, also talk about this political moment, I would say, in the idea of what is truth and what people will believe and what people, at several points, the bad guy's plan kind of falters a little bit, and his minions are like, how are you gonna do this? And he's like, people will believe anything. And there's a mid-credit sequence that also, I would argue, kind of speaks to this little moment. A welcome return of an old character in a context that I found actually pretty amusing. But I also feel like you either have to commit to that bit or not. And I feel like it kind of pops it in, the idea of truth and people, what people want to believe, and they'll believe anything if it makes them feel safer or whatever. That shows up a little bit, but not enough. I wish they built the whole plane out of that. But they don't. They just kind of touch on it. That was an idea, like, okay, there is some idea of that in this. It feels almost perfunctory the way it just kind of tosses it in.
Yeah, and I will say that, you know, I would say in general, you're higher on Spider-Man movies than I am. But the point that you bring up makes me think of Spider-Man 2, the second Tobey Maguire film, which came out post 9/11 and felt in certain ways like a movie about New York coming together, especially in the scene that people talk about the most from that movie, a scene that you talk about a ton, in terms of this idea of, like, New York has been through some stuff, but New Yorkers come together. And that feeling that comes through in Spider-Man 2 is subtle. It's not the entire movie, but it's an idea that is part of that film. How could you not, if you're going to make a movie in New York and that comes out like in 2004 or whatever? And this movie feels more like, I mean, frankly, let's go back to the, you know, Spider-Man Homecoming. That movie had a great bad guy. Michael Keaton's terrific in that movie. And that character, his badness is built around a feeling about being sort of an aggrieved, like, working class guy who feels like he's been left behind. And a lot of people, including me, wrote pieces about, like, oh, this in some ways, like, he is a Trump voter in certain ways. Maybe that was a little overdone, but you felt that. You understood that in the character. And this one, it just, the bad guy's plan in this movie is kind of James Bond villainish, I would say, in certain ways, where it's like, I want to control things because the media or, like, you know, stuff. And I'm like, well, I would just like to think if you and I become super villains, which, you know,
could happen.
Fingers crossed, you know, that our plan would be less of a twisted altruistic thing and more just like revenge against our enemies, which I'm kind of building towards anyway at this point. That seems fine to me.
Yeah, I just leave me out of it, man. We're friends. All right, what did you give it?
I gave it a low C+. That's actually, this is one of my least favorite of the MCU films.
I'm sad to say I don't have the bell. I'm in Buffalo right now, so I don't have my bell, but I would be ringing the bell right now. I also gave this a C+. I would agree. This is toward the very bottom. I think it's better than the Ant-Man movies. You know how I feel about the Ant-Man movies. I don't really like those very much. It's better than those. But remember, you're talking to people that love Thor 2 or The Lost World. So, you know, we may be not the best base on this. But yeah, I agree. I think this is one of the worst Marvel movies. And it makes sense. Like, again, they're clearly in some sort of transitional period. It just feels weird to have Spider-Man be part of the transitional period.
Yeah, but people have to pay money to see the transitional period movie. You know, like, that's sort of...
Still counts. Counts as much as the game did.
Yeah. I love, by the way, you're in Buffalo. I'm actually in San Francisco right now. We're both on the road this week.
This is part of our honoring cities where O.J. Simpson played professional football tour.
In case, bring it all around. Bring it full circle right there.
Okay, now we go to our second and final new movie of the week. That movie is Midsummer.
I told you that I want to go to that festival in Sweden.
No, you said it would be cool to go.
Yeah, and then I got the opportunity and I decided
Look,
to do it.
I don't mind you going. I just wish you would have told me, that's all.
Dude, she needs a therapist. You've been wanting out of this stupid relationship for like a year now.
And don't forget about all of the beautiful Swedish women you'll meet in June.
Okay, guys.
That's not her again. Seriously?
Babe, what's happening? Danny.
Midsummer is the second film from writer-director Ari Aster, who just about a year ago released his debut film, Hereditary, which was number 2 on Will's list last year.
That movie's awesome. That movie is awesome.
It was number 11 on my list. We're both big fans. This is Midsummer, and this is a movie that Aster had been writing before he wrote Hereditary, which makes it easier if you have something ready after your first movie is a huge hit. Sundance is going to be coming out in the summer. You can turn around and make another movie really quickly. This movie stars Florence Pugh as Dani. And she's a college student. I'm not sure if she's grad or undergrad, not that it really matters, but she suffers from depression and anxiety, as we will learn in the really, really effective intro of Midsummer. She has plenty of reason to feel the way she does and to be as rattled as she is. There's sort of an opening kind of prologue that sets the scene for something terrible that will occur in her family. What she does not realize is her boyfriend Christian, played by Jack Rayner, has been kind of wanting to dump her for a while. It's not that he doesn't like her, but she's kind of a handful and his friends think she's kind of a mess and he would be better off without her. And there's only so many other girls are kind of into him anyway. Maybe he should break up with her. When something terrible happens in Danny's personal life, Christian feels guilty and feels like he can't break up with her. And so he stays with her. And he feels so bad for her that, in fact, Christian and his buddies, including Good Place favorite William Jackson Harper, who plays Josh, and Will Poulter, who you've seen in Detroit, and We're the Millers, two very different films, very different, who plays Mark in this movie. These are friends of Christian. They're all going to go with a buddy of theirs who is from Sweden. They're going to go with their friend to that guy's very small town, rural community in Sweden, where they do this ancient ceremony like once every like 90 years or something like that. And so they all want to go. They think it sounds really kind of cool and exciting. And even though they weren't going to invite Danny, Christian feels too guilty. And so he kind of invites her along. And she is happy to go, but she kind of also knows that she's the third wheel among him and his buddies who insist that she's not. But we all kind of know that that's what's going on. They go to the small community in Sweden, which is very idyllic. It's out in the woods. Everybody is very welcoming. Very, very normal. Definitely nothing weird is going on in this community. They quickly discover that because of where they are in Sweden, it's almost permanent daylight all day long. So if you go to bed, the sun is still out. It's still bright the entire time. That creates a very interesting dynamic for a horror movie, because we're used to horror movies, especially Hereditary, where terrible things happen at night. A lot of the terrible things that happen in Midsummer happen during broad daylight. And that is incredibly unnerving, because we have come to expect in horror movies that when the sun is out, you can take a breath, because that's when the bad things will not occur. The bad things happen when the sun is out in Midsummer. When you make a movie like Hereditary and you are sort of declared as maybe one of the next big things in sort of elevated horror or whatever dumb expression we're calling these movies now, there's a certain amount of pressure for your sophomore release, and how you sort of handle your second movie is always, I think, kind of interesting. I think what Ari Aster has done is probably the best version of how to deal with the sophomore slump. I guess the best version would be to make a movie as great as Hereditary, but what he does instead is make a movie that is more ambitious, tries a lot of things, has a lot of things going on. Not all of them are successful, and we'll get into that in a little bit. But I have to say that on the whole, I'm down with a movie like Midsommar. I thought about movies, you know, people will give you the comparisons in terms of classic horror films like The Shining and Rosemary's Baby and The Wicker Man in terms of the influences that are, you know, kind of seeping in to Midsommar. But I also thought of something like last year's Suspiria, which is a movie that also like bit off more than it could chew. But there's so many ideas going on in these movies, and they kind of upend the idea of what a horror movie is supposed to be like, what it's supposed to feel like, what it's supposed to be about. And on one level, this film is predictable. You know that bad things are going to happen when they go to this village, but you don't know exactly what's going to happen and why they're going to happen and how you're going to feel about it. And for the most part, I was willing to kind of go along with what Midsommar does. It is an uneven movie. There are things that do not work. This movie is like 2 hours and 20 minutes or something like that. It's probably too long. It takes its time. But where it lands, where it ends, I thought, you know what? I would rather somebody try this than not take risks. I mean, I think a lot of the themes of this summer are people kind of just, like with Spider-Man Far From Home, doing a sequel, doing a remake, doing a reboot, doing another installment of a franchise that you've seen. Midsommar takes legitimate risks. I can't wait to see what the cinema score is going to be for this movie. If there's an F minus, maybe, because let's not forget, Hereditary got a D plus, and that movie is across the board fantastic. Midsommar's more of a mess. I can't imagine how people are going to respond to it. It is not perfect, but I think it's really, really, really good.
I don't like it as much as you. I admire it more than I like it is probably the best way to put it. I agree with everything you're saying. This is a cool way to do it, to respond to Hereditary, to do something that really, you know, I don't want to give away. You talk about the beginning. The beginning feels a little like Hereditary, right? Mm-hmm. Like the beginning of the movie feels like, oh, this is the guy that made Hereditary. What's he going to do now? And then the movie shifts and they go to this place in Sweden and it turns into something different. And I admire that he did something different. And there's a lot of skill of what he does in that too. The guy's the real deal. I mean, the guy is no question the real deal. There's a part of me that feels that to take on the challenge of kind of what you talk about, to do a movie where all the horrible things happen in broad daylight and there is no relief and there's no, and even when they go to bed, it's funny, if anything, they're more relieved when they go to sleep, even though there's a screaming baby randomly every time they try to sleep in this movie, which is not, does not make it easy to sleep on its own. I admire the ambition. I admire the big swing. Not everything connects enough for me the way that it does in Hereditary to where I think that where I can put it even really kind of close into the same league. This movie has a great benefit that Hereditary also has, which is an incredible lead performance by a lead actress. We've talked about Florence Pugh, about how much we liked her in Fighting With Her Family Elaine Macbeth. She was really good in that. There is something about her that is almost too expressive, if that makes sense. It is, there are times, obviously some very horrible, gross, terrible things happen in this movie, but like just watching her, it's funny, the poster for this movie is just a close-up of her face with a tear coming down, and it is as hard to look at as anything in this movie. She's not always like truly like terrified or horrified in the way, she doesn't go as big as Toni Collette does in Hereditary, but what she does is almost just as good. And it's funny too, the movie sets up a lot of things that it follows up, sets up a lot of things concretely, but then follows up metaphorically, which I have to say is one of my pet peeves. It's something that I always, again, it's one of those things I admire intellectually, but find frustrating sometimes while watching the movie. And I do feel like one of the great things, this is one of the terrific, terrific scenes in this movie is, again, before they get to Sweden. I will confess, I think I like the stuff in Sweden a little bit more, before they get to Sweden a little bit more than they like Sweden, because it just feels sharper. And there's this great scene where Christian, played by Jack Rayner, has done something very terrible, been terrible to her, has not been helpful, has not been responsive to what she needs, and blows up at her about it, and is the total jerk, and she while absolutely justified and still strong-willed, totally backs down. It's like, I'm sorry, you're right. She convinces herself that she's wrong and says that this is her problem. And there's something about that, the way that she plays it, where you can see in her eyes she knows she's actually right, but just feels like, you know what, the easier thing for me is to just let this go. And you see a little bit when that gets to Sweden, and part of the journey of the movie is her not doing that anymore and almost feeling like this crazy place where these crazy things are happening is almost maybe more in tune with who she is and the way she sees the world, which is interesting. And certainly the way some of that plays out lands in very fascinating places. The way that sometimes goes is maybe a bit much. I love William Jackson Harper. I actually like Will Poulter. They still feel like a little bit of, the minute you see them, like, okay, so how are these guys going to get it? And there's a subplot involving a thesis that I will confess I did not find riveting. Would probably be the best way to put that.
Wait, are you saying that a plot line about a thesis is not inherently exciting?
Yeah, like the movie's too long. The movie is too long. The movie.
Yeah, I agree, by the way, about the thesis part. That's I think one of the weak links in this film.
Yeah, like it's too long. There's a little bit too much going on. I feel like there's stuff in here that you can tighten a little bit. I do think there's a little bit of. Because Hereditary is so inherently terrifying and winds you up and really pays all that off, there's this, I think, because this is his second movie, part of what he wants to do is be like, you know what, I can also do this. I can freak you out all the way through. Because that's the thing with Hereditary, this is the great joke about Hereditary, is you spend like an hour and a half going, wow, this movie's so unsettling, and then you're like, holy fuck, and then he turns the crank, and then everything is completely for loose. This feels both... It feels like a combination of that, to where the grip doesn't tighten quite as tight and the release isn't as strong, but it's still interested in freaking you out more than it is to like truly terrifying you, which it works. And, but I will say I didn't find it as satisfying as Hereditary. I found it like, okay, I like that he did this. I like, this is the direction he went with this. This is a fascinating way to do it. I hope he's kind of gotten this out of his system now. It's probably the way to think of it. It reminded me a little bit, you talk about CinemaScore, it reminded me a little bit of Mother, right? Like this feels like someone working something out. and in a way that I'm like, good, I'm glad you've done that. You are obviously really, really skilled at this. I would like maybe the next thing to move on from this a little bit.
Yeah, it was funny. When he introduced this movie at its sort of first screening, Astor didn't say too much beforehand, but he said, so this was inspired by a breakup I went through, but I'm doing better now. And that really is, I think, as many people have said, that's kind of the secret. I mean, what this movie is kind of about. What I like about, I agree with you, I think that the intro, that kind of prologue, is kind of a perfect short film. It really is incredibly well done. It's really wonderfully smartly done. But I would say that while the stuff in Sweden is a little more ragged in certain ways, it feels like the playing out of what has happened in a more kind of broader sort of way. Everything that has been established at the beginning, what happens when they get over there is the culmination of everything that was in the beginning of the movie. And so in some ways that like that shift in tone and feel and just look, the way the look of the movie is at the beginning versus when they get to Sweden is satisfying enough. That's a trope that I tend to kind of dig, where it's like, here's something and now the rest of the movie is like a different way of expressing the same kind of thing. That being said, the thesis part is a problem in the movie. And I think the problem is also that I think that there are too many ideas. And I think that not entirely successfully, what Ari Aster is doing is sort of saying, these guys that she went on this trip with are kind of all terrible in selfish, self-centered kind of ways. And so he wants to play that out by giving all the characters something to do when they're not as interesting as characters. Jack Rayner, I think, is sort of interesting in this movie because he is not necessarily an actor where I'm like, oh, Jack Reiner is in this awesome. Like, he doesn't necessarily, he does not jump out to me. Like, he's been in Sing Street and he's been like one of the Transformers movies and whatever. And there is something vaguely, boringly handsome about him that I think actually works in this movie, because there is something about that character, the Christian character, where he is like a lot of dudes, where it's like, I'm good looking, I like chicks. And that he actually, there's nothing inside him. Like, there's nothing actually kind of interesting about him. And I think that that actually is weaponized in kind of a nice way in this movie. And also, I agree 100%. Florence Pugh is tremendous. And I think especially what she does, going back to Rosemary's Baby. Rosemary's Baby is one of my all-time favorite films. And one of the things I love whenever I watch it is to just watch Mia Farrow play a character who is being gaslit and tricked and fooled and manipulated. And every time I watch it, I never think that this character is stupid. I never think, why isn't this character no better? And that, I think, is one of the genius things about that movie and her performance, is that you never think that she is dumb. You know that she is smart, but that maybe she's too trusting. And you never, your judgment is never against her in the movie. And Florence Pugh does the same thing. And I'm really glad you brought up that scene that you talked about in terms of where Florence Pugh's character, Danny, backs down, because there is something I think so perfect about the way a pushover can be in those situations where they feel like, I don't want to fight, I don't want any conflict, I'll just go along. I'll go along.
Even though she knows she's right. Even though she knows she's right. And we get across that, we get the impression that she knows she's right. Right. She's like, you know what? I'm not going to do this now.
Yeah, and I think what connects Florence Pugh and Mia Farrow in these situations is that in both cases you think, okay, the character is maybe a little too trusting or a little too much of a pushover, but I know that this actress is smart. I know that they're smart, and so I know that this is something that they are playing, and that because the actor is smart, I know that there's more going on inside their heads. And because I think it's tough, because what Danny does in the first half of this movie is kind of get pushed into this situation. She's passive. She's weak in a lot of ways. But you don't watch Midsommar and go, oh, well, she's dumb. Why does she do this? Why does she do that? It makes complete sense. And as you said, the movie is about kind of her evolution from that to the person that she's going to become. And that's what Florence Pugh did so great in Lady Macbeth. It's not a dissimilar transformation that those characters go through, though it's different in certain kind of ways. They make you think they're one type of person, and then you realize that they have something else inside them. And maybe it's always been there, kind of waiting to kind of get out. And that's really impressive. You know how much I love Toni Collette in Hereditary, and that's a magnificent performance. In some ways, this is trickier, because in some ways, this performance requires you to assume one thing about the character and discover something else. Both movies are about grief, as all horror movies are. Like, it's not any grand revelation to be like, well, really, this film is about the grieving process. But this movie is about the grieving process in a certain way. It's about relationships and being with a bad partner and kind of dealing with that. I want to be careful with spoilers. There is an explanation for something that is going to happen, but there are one of several shocking things that occur in this movie. I would argue that people seem relatively chill about the horrible thing that happens in this movie.
Yes.
It is such a bravura, like, it is such an upsetting, a genuinely upset, even if you can see it kind of coming, it's genuinely upsetting. I would argue that it is so upsetting, I don't think that the characters, the American characters, respond in as much of a way as I think generally anybody who is watching the scene would react.
Yes.
That is actually, I think, where the movie starts to lose momentum. Because I think at that moment, it's like, well, wait a second. You guys don't want to do redacted, redacted, redacted.
You're gonna sit down and have lunch now?
Right? Yes. Right. And I think those are the things that you're kind of talking about, but I also agree with, where when you're operating on this high of a level, as Astor is, you kind of can't do things where you go, wait a second. Because when you say wait a second, then you get pulled out of the illusion of the film. And there are too many of those. It's not just the fact that there's too many of those. Because the movie itself is too long, it gives you too much time to say, wait a second, I'm actually thinking now, and this doesn't make sense, and this doesn't work as smoothly, and wait a second. But at the same time, I had someone email me this week who is not, gets freaked out by horror movies, and he asked me, like, do I think Midsommar is, like, you know, because some people will say, like, well, is this actually a horror movie, is it more of a psychological thriller? I think that for most people, this is going to freak them out. It's not a horror movie like, you know, Freddy kills a bunch of people.
Yeah, it's not Annabelle. Them. Right.
Yeah. It's not one of the Annabelle films. It's not The Conjuring, that kind of thing. But, you know, it is gruesome and tough and upsetting and things like that. So if you're someone maybe who's inclined to stay away from horror movies, even though maybe you've heard good things about this one, go in knowing that it's tough in certain ways, and it's tough in different ways than Hereditary was, which was also, you know, had some really, really upsetting stuff in it.
I think this is less upsetting than Hereditary, not because it's any, like, it's somehow tamer to any stretch of the imagination, but Hereditary is just so tight. And this doesn't feel as tight. If it's good, and there's a lot of freaky stuff in it, and there's a lot of great ideas in it, it's just not as tight as that movie is, and which is fine. But it's also not sprawling in a way that a lot of second movies are, too. Right? It's ambitious, but it's not insanely out of control ambitious. He's still. And I just wish the whole movie was as tight as his first 20 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, this movie feels very much more self-consciously epic. It is reaching for that kind of epic grandeur. The last thing I will say is that, you know, this is not, I mean, this movie has some special effects, but some of the special effects are so beautifully, subtly done in this movie. My recommendation, and I don't think this is a spoiler, keep watching the background when they go to Sweden. It is, I think, remarkable. What in terms of certain things, in terms of how things are constructed, in terms of how you create unease in a viewer, I think Astor does it really, really well.
All right. So what did you give it?
I give it a B+. There are things that don't work. There are things I simply couldn't go with in this movie, but I give it a B+.
I give it a B. And does this get, I mean, we haven't seen the cinema score yet. Maybe people will see it when they listen to it. This feels like people are going to react to this like they did to Mother.
A friend of mine asked me, do they actually grade or get grades from people who walk out? Like, you know, because I think cinema score is done like for people at the end of the movie. But what if like you're like halfway through this, I can't deal with it. Well, I actually have the cinema score right now for Midsommar. Would you like to guess what it is?
D.
I cannot believe this. It is a C+.
Hey, wow, look at that. It's better than Hereditary.
Now, for argument's sake, this may be a self-selecting audience, and they knew what they were getting themselves into in a certain way. But yes, C+ seems miraculous.
I will say it's also worth noting that, like, Mother, for example, people knew nothing about Mother other than that Jennifer Lawrence was in it. It was a little creepy.
Right.
And so people like came into Mother and they were like, holy, what the fuck is this? Right. And so I can see why Mother would do worse than this.
Yeah. I mean, I think if you want to see Midsommar, you kind of know, okay,
right.
It's like a Who Did Hereditary. I've heard it's kind of intense. Whereas Hereditary, it's like, oh, it's a like a ghost story or something. Right, and right, people right. being like, what the hell is this? Why isn't it scarier?
Why did she just, yeah. And then Mother's like, why did she eat a baby? Why did they eat a baby? Why did they eat a baby exactly? All right. So that is, I'm going to go into a Mother discussion again, Grayson. Maybe we should move on from that one.
Let us not do all right. that.
So that is Midsommar. All right, now we go to our reboot movie. Our reboot movie this week is Ocean's 11.
It's never been done before.
What's the target?
When was the last time you were in Vegas?
You want to knock over a casino.
Three casinos?
Oh.
Vegas. Vegas, huh?
Vegas?
Vegas.
Fantastic.
The heist is impossible.
Casino security cannot be beaten. You're out of your minds.
Exactly.
Ocean's 11. I did watch the first 10, Grierson, so I was able to appropriately
Ocean's 8 this. Was Ocean's 8 did not come before.
Yeah, very confusing. I just thought it was.
I thought that was a pre. That's not a prelude. Yeah.
Is I'm like, man, this movie really ripped that Ocean's 8 movie off. This is directed by Steven.
Someone tell Mr. Clooney.
Directed, of course, by Steven Soderbergh. It's kind of interesting to see where this was in Soderbergh's career, right? This was after kind of Out of Sight had come. He'd done Out of Sight, and then he'd done Traffic and Aaron Brockovich at this point, right? Yeah. So
he was an Oscar winner by this point.
He was on a roll, to say the very least. And so then he makes Ocean's 11, which is, of course, a remake of I've never seen it, but from all accounts, kind of dumb Rat Pack movie from back in 1960. Well, this one, of course, has the big movie stars of the time. Though it's funny to think of that because there's a joke actually early on in the movie where Danny Ocean is together with the five dumbass TV actors that are getting poker lessons from Rusty, and off camera, a very Soderberghian thing to do is to have off camera, you hear George Clooney ask Topher Grace, so crossing over from television to film, is that hard? Which is exactly, of course, the kind of conversation that George Clooney was probably facing still, even at the time of this movie, because the movie is almost 20 years old, Grierson. Holy shit. It is, of course, about Danny Ocean. We see Danny Ocean being paroled after being busted for apparently years of larceny. And clever cons. As soon as he gets out, turns out he spent that time in jail thinking of a big plan to not only get Terry Benedict, played by Andy Garcia, a major casino owner in Las Vegas, but also get his ex-wife, Tess, played by Julia Roberts, back. He gets the crew together. One of the many delights of Ocean's 11 is just simply the heist movie trope of let's get the team together. And it's just very, very entertaining pretty much across the board. It's funny to think too, when you think about Ocean's 11, the idea that like, it does feel like this collaborative, it feels, we should just get into it because it's Ocean's 11, man. This is like this movie, everyone's seen Ocean's 11.
They get away with it.
You monster. How could you have done that? There is a certain, one of the things we talked about, I forget what we were talking about, the idea of one of the worries of Ocean's 11, there was going to be a smugness to it, right? There was going to be a certain, look at all these rich, high-powered movie stars all just having a smug fest on screen. This movie is cool, but it is not smug. It feels, that's the Soderbergh thing, right? That's why Soderbergh is the perfect guy to direct this movie. It feels like they're all, it's a heist movie where it feels like the people that are making it are getting away with something. And that is exciting to watch. It's exciting. It's still exciting to watch almost 20 years later. It feels like there are certain things that maybe have not aged perfectly. And we've also seen Steven Soderbergh not only make two Ocean's 11 movies, but even refer back to these Ocean's 11 movies and make movies like them. It's hard now to watch even a movie like High Flying Bird and not feel like some sort of connection to Ocean's 11 in a certain way. Like this feels like almost this and Out of Sight are the pure on tap kind of Soderbergh things. And it's all Soderbergh here. This is just a heist movie, but of course it's not that. It's so much of it. The patter is great. The one of the things I've forgotten how much I love is that scene where Danny Ocean and Terry Benedict and Tess Ocean are at the table and just talking, and Danny, Terry, Tess, it's just perfect. It feels in a movie that feels like hip and of the moment, also feels like a callback to the 50s, but even, not just like the Rat Pack, but a callback to like, to the old patter front page sort of fun patter romantic comedies of like of an earlier time. It really feels like Soderbergh getting away with something. It feels like everyone is having a blast, but it comes across. It's winking, but not irritatingly so. Ocean's 11 was incredibly fun the first time I saw it. It's just as much fun to watch it now.
It is a... I wasn't really concerned because I do watch this on cable every once in a while, like parts of it. It was a relief to know it's still pretty terrific. The context, I think, is actually kind of funny because this came out December of 2001. And I still remember very kind of vividly you know, 9/11 had just happened like 3 months before. And, you know, people, you know, studios were delaying movies because they had too close of real world connections to what had happened in terms of terrorist attacks and whatever. This is one of those movies I remember when it came out, just watching and being like, oh, thank God. Like, I can just enjoy this because it is cut off from, you know, reality in a fun but very smart way. I think one of the reasons why this movie, we talked about this last week, was such a huge hit is I think this was the one movie where it was like, no, you can actually have fun. It's actually okay. You can actually just enjoy yourself at the movies and not feel like a bad griever in terms of just watching something and just enjoy your life for a couple hours. And that context is important in terms of what it was like then. It still works really well now. You talked about, you know, Soderbergh getting away with it. And I very vividly remember seeing trailers for this and just thinking, oh boy, because I like Soderbergh and I like Clooney and I like Brad Pitt and I like Julia Roberts. All four of them, I would argue, have the ability to be pretty pleased with themselves on screen, and that can be a problem. And that, for the most part, doesn't happen here. It is, not only do they get away with it, they understand tonally exactly, like exactly what this has to be, which is, you said cool, definitely cool, fun, but it has to be restrained enough that you actually don't feel like they're smirking at you the whole time. You also have to feel like while you're watching it, that you are on these guys' side. I think one of the things that's least praised about this movie is it's not just big movie stars, which they are, but you instantly like basically everybody as soon as you meet them in this movie. Everybody is so incredibly appealing, and they are appealing in a way that you feel like, oh, like I'm part of the team. You actually feel like you're on the inside. You're not on the outside watching other like famous rich people having fun. You are actually having fun simultaneously with them. I will always remember in 2000, the year before this movie came out, LA Weekly, when Manolo Dargis was there, did an interview with Steven Soderbergh, and he was prepping Ocean's 11. And I actually pulled it up before we were going to talk about it. And like, just some of his quotes, I still remember like him saying, I'm terrified. I referred to the movie as a wind-up toy and like talked to David Fincher about like, yeah, how do you do like this and this and this and this and this? Because this was, I mean, he had done Out of Sight, but he had never done a movie like this. I mean, Traffic is incredibly complex and layered and all of that. And Aaron Brockovich is a crowd pleaser, obviously. But this is a different kind of thing. And he had never done this before. And part of the pleasure of Ocean's 11, especially the first time you saw it when it came out, was like, oh my God, he can do this too? Like, and that was exciting. Like, that actually felt like there was the joy. We talk about this sometime with stars. We talk about it with Florence Pugh, where it's like, wait, you're this really great actress, but you could also be like a movie star and do that too, and that's really exciting. Watching Ocean's 11 was like, oh my God, this filmmaker I love can also do this entirely pleasurable mainstream action comedy thriller heist movie, and it feels like a big blockbuster. It doesn't feel like, okay, I'll do one of these like mainstream kind of movies. He doesn't condescend to the material. Instead, it's really smart. It's really well edited. Sometimes he edits his own stuff, but Stephen Maroney edited this. And it's just like this time while watching, I was just like watching how it's just constructed. We get this information. We get this information. A lot of this movie is simply not just information distribution, but also like where are characters in space, especially because like the last hour is the heist and there's all like, where is everybody? What's going on? And it's also emotional. I had kind of forgotten how much I love the stuff with George Clooney and Julia Roberts, especially that first scene that you referenced a little bit, that scene is not, it's not heartbreaking. It's not emotionally like devastating. But it's nice and it's subtle and it works really well. And in some ways, it's a callback to Out of Sight in terms of some of the stuff that Soderbergh did. But it gives you emotional stakes and you actually do kind of care about what happened. I mean, and the last thing for me is like, you know, maybe someone's written about this, but I think this movie, but I think the Ocean's movies in general are in some ways, I feel, like a commentary on acting and acting being lying. Because one of the pleasures of the movie is that people are lying and conning, especially when people are wearing disguises and stuff. And there's something that I feel like the actors in this movie understand inherently. Brad Pitt looks ridiculous as the doctor when he comes in. And the movie knows that. And I would argue that the movie is actually saying, in fact, this is what actors do for a living. This is actually what they do. They wear funny wigs. They wear funny glasses. And they act in ways that are not like themselves. And we buy it. And I actually think that that is actually something that's it's subtle. It's not a big thing in the movie, but it's part of what's going on. You know, Don Cheadle has an accent. People are doing different things. Carl Reiner's entire thing is doing different impressions and like that. The movie, to me, also feels like there's a really kind of interesting essay about how actors do what they do. And I think that's part of why the performance is so good, because I think there's something that they inherently understand about that that makes it really fun, too.
Yeah, it is. It's so much fun. It really is. And I like to talk a little bit too about Matt Damon in this movie, because Matt Damon's a pretty big star. One of my favorite things about Matt Damon, particularly around this time, is for him to kind of take on this role, right? Like Matt Damon and Steven Spielberg have done many movies together. And I think that Matt Damon's been terrific in a lot of them, and like this clearly forceful leading man presence. And here he gets to play like this, I don't know, this feels like a character that like Giovanni Ribisi would play or something, like, right? Like, yeah. And so for Matt Damon to play him, and to play him so fun, and to play him so young, and almost as if like Matt Damon's probably at this point a bigger movie star than George Clooney, maybe? I mean, maybe.
Possibly. Yeah, I mean,
yeah, like, they're certainly close.
This is all pre-Jason Bourne, which I think is interesting. Yeah,
but I mean, certainly like Matt Damon, like he was in Saving Private Ryan, he's been talented, like he's really been a lot of stuff. And George Clooney, while probably has a bigger celebrity, like Matt Damon, for him to like take this kind of role and then to build on it and make it kind of more interesting as the movies went along, sometimes but for the better and sometimes for the worse. I don't know. I've always kind of liked Matt Damon, particularly in these movies, because he's very... I don't know. He's very he seems like, you know what? I'm game. I think it speaks to the fun of the whole enterprise. He's like, you know what, Steven, I trust you. Like, just let's go. Let's go do this. And there is something very, very enjoyable about that. I think it's a reminder, as you kind of talked about, Soderbergh can do anything. Soderbergh can do anything, and while still making it feel like a Soderberghian movie.
Yeah, and also I think the score is really fun. I think Andy Garcia is kind of underrated in terms of how good he is in this, because I think he actually sort of exudes menace with actually not ever really raising his voice. And I think he's a fun villain in the movie. Like it's a pleasure, because he's kind of cocky, he's kind of arrogant, and it's delightful when he gets taken at the end. Like you actually enjoy that. I also really love the movie. I said, you know, they get away with it. Well, they kind of do. And I actually really love that there is something that is in a great way tossed off about this movie. That it feels like this is just a chapter in a longer saga. And we'll probably never make another movie. They did. They ended up making two more. But there's something about it that feels self-contained, but also like, yeah, this is part of a larger kind of world. And you said this last week, Will, in terms of introducing this movie, it is like Clooney and Pitt and Julia Roberts. It's like now this movie is almost 20. I mean, it's 18 years old now. Like how young they all look is quite something. Also, we can't talk about Ocean's 11 without mentioning it is a delight to watch Brad Pitt eat as much as he does in this movie. This is so fun. You know, in terms of things to lament, I remember at some point watching this on DVD in the commentary track. I think there's a really good, I know there's like the one that he did for The Limey is kind of more famous because he and the writer basically disagree about the movie while they're doing the commentary track. But Soderbergh talking about Ocean's 11, I remember watching that and really being impressed in terms, because he talks a lot about just the technical of how this whole thing comes together. And sorry, there are a lot of funny jokes. This may be Soderbergh's funniest film. The thing that makes me laugh the hardest is when Don Cheadle's character is going to turn on that thing and he wonders, should I protect my like male areas, my genitals. It's such a funny thing. It's like, yeah, maybe you should. And maybe actually won't make a difference because of what that thing actually does. You know, it's like, there are moments like that, you know, everything we've said, that it feels like they're getting away with something. It feels in the best way that they were kind of winging it as they went along, but they came up with the best idea over and over again. Every time they knew what the right joke was, line was. Even the great thing where Clooney says, you know, because the house always wins, but the one time, and he does that whole thing. And that is such a, I remember that in the trailer and thinking, oh God, it works so well in the movie. And yet it works also because in the movie, he says a thing that's supposed to seem really serious, but he's actually just a line. And then later when Brad Pitt finds out that it's partly because of Tess, and he says, you know how we said, do this as if you'd never, you know, don't worry about losing something. Well, I lost something. And there's actually enough gravitas in that moment to go, oh, that's actually why. This is actually the moment of him being real. Those are small things, but they build up.
Yeah. It's just really good. This movie's really good. Ocean's 11. It makes me curious to go, like, I haven't watched Ocean's 12 or 13 in a while. All I remember liking 12 and 13, not thinking Ellen Barkin, the stuff worked very well at all, and not thinking that Al Pacino was that great either, but still being happy to see those guys. But it's been a while. And 12 was so weird. But like, all I really remember from 12 is the Bruce Willis stuff. That's actually the stuff, yeah, I remember the most.
The whole running joke of like, do you think Tess looks a lot like, no, no. And yeah, then that pays off. That was the big fight at the time. Like, is that stupid, yes, of her playing herself? I actually think it's great. I always thought that was really, really, I haven't watched that whole movie in a while, but I actually like 12 and 13. Not as much as 11, but yeah.
13 was the one I liked the least, if memory serves me
correctly. That's kind of the way I felt too, yeah.
All right. So that is Ocean's 11. Good stuff. Good show. Soderbergh, that guy's got some skills. Next movie is got Meryl Streep in it, Gershon.
That is correct. And they don't, is there a release date? I'm trying to think.
It's a Netflix movie, so who knows? Finally getting the Meryl Streep, David Schwimmer combo we have been waiting for years.
They got my letters. This is great. I've been asking for that.
All right. So that is our show this week. We have two new movies and one reboot. Though I got to tell you, Gershon, there's a non-zero chance that I'm going to skip that second movie. Because when you look at the release schedule, I'm like, I'll see it if I have to. But we'll get there in a second. A movie we're definitely going to talk about is The Farewell, which is written and directed by Lulu Wang. Stars Awkwafina. It was a big hit at Sundance this year, correct? Did you see it at Sundance?
I saw it at Sundance. It was a big hit there. Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
So I saw this. And our pal Richard Brody at the screening of this in New York and really nerded out. This is who I nerd out to. I don't nerd out to athletes or celebrities. I nerd out to writers, film critics and writers. That's who I nerd out to. He was very polite.
Incredibly bearded, bespeckled.
Yeah. Yeah, but still young and vibrant.
Master film critics, what?
So young and vibrant. I was impressed by it. He had more. I'd seen him from afar before, but the guy's got some spry to his step.
Is that what you said to him?
No, I think I just went.
I hope someday I meet one of our listeners in person who says, "You got some. You're just kind of spry.
That's a spry to your step." I figured you'd just be slouched in that chair, dreaming of hot tubs with Spuds McKenzie. So that's The Farewell.
Yes, I teleported to the past.
Yes, The Farewell. So the second movie, I don't know, Gershon, you've seen this movie. I'm going to try to see it. We have to have three movies on the show. Maybe we'll come up with something else to do. I don't know. I haven't decided yet.
We'll give our gardening tips.
My level of enthusiasm to see this movie, as you might be able to tell, is low. But the movie is Stuber. Stuber is directed by Michael Dowse, with Kumail Nanjiani, who we love, and Dave Bautista, who's been pretty funny, and Mira Sorvino, who's awesome, and Karen Gillan, and I don't know, I just get Natalie Morales. I like her, but I don't know.
You just go see Crawl instead.
Should I see Crawl instead?
I haven't seen it. People don't know when it's going to be screened for critics or if it's going to be, but there's always Crawl.
I even looked up at Netflix. Netflix has got a movie with... It's got a movie. I don't think it's going to get a release, though. I don't think it's going to get a theatrical release, so we can't do it. We could do our Tarantino discussion, because at one point we're going to do like a Tarantino discussion. But you've seen his new movie, and I haven't. So yeah, that would not be good. So we can't really do that. Yeah, we can't really do that.
This is very exciting. Our listeners get to listen to our production meetings.
If you have any suggestions, just email me what we should do instead of Stuber, because I really don't want to see Stuber. I just don't want to.
It's not that long. It's only 93 minutes long.
Yeah, but you know, this weekend I'm going to Busch Stadium. Every year my son William and I go to a Cardinals series, and it's very exciting. We get an Airbnb. We go to the games. It's really fun. It's always a good time. Last year, he hung out with Fred Bird. And Fred Burke can be trusted. He's one of the mascots you can trust.
Right. He's not a Jake Gyllenhaal.
Yeah, exactly. Fred Burke's cool. Fred Burke's cool. Gritty. Anyway.
Wait, hold on. You don't like Gritty?
No, I just said you can't trust him.
Oh, yeah, that is true. Yeah. Those eyeballs. He's seen some stuff, that guy.
He'll steal the pants off you.
I just love that you name dropped Fred Bird. Like,
I know.
He's hanging out with people like Fred Bird.
Yeah, just Fred Bird and... anyway, the point is I'm going to be gone next weekend. I have time to come back and see Stuber before we do the show. I just don't want to. So right. if anyone has a suggestion, I will do it if I have to, because we can't just talk about The Farewell and our reboot movie. But if anyone has suggestions of something we should do, email me. If something you've been wanting to hear for a while that doesn't require me watching Stuber. If not, I'll just fucking see Stuber. All right, here we go to our reboot movie. Our reboot movie is 2010's Poetry, written and directed, by Lee Chang-dong, who, of course, did a movie that... What was the name of the movie that you liked? Burning. Oh, yeah. Grierson likes him some Burning.
Yeah, it's my favorite film of last year. And in your top 10.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Well. Burning is great. And that is the last movie he's made. This is the last movie he made before that. So have you seen any of his other movies? Secret Sunshine, Oasis, Greenfish,
Peppermint Candy? Secret Sunshine, I have seen... Actually, on the big screen. Poetry, I have actually... I have seen, but never in a theater, sadly. But no,
that's not going to start now.
Yeah, no. Oasis and his early stuff was available on Amazon Prime, actually, and I don't know if it is currently. But it was this like weird thing where people discover and they're not available on Netflix. I actually had checked that, though. Burning is still. If you can see Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse and Burning, that's a weird double feature, but they're both really good movies.
It doesn't matter. They're just going to watch a movie with Adam Sandler in an oversized t-shirt. That's Netflix. That's what's going to...
According to their stats, 20 quadrillion people saw it.
It's a lot of people.
What was it called? Murder Mystery?
Murder Mystery.
Written by...
I don't know who.
James Vanderbilt, the writer of Zodiac.
Oh, well, that's good. I mean, there's something about even the title of that. This like, yeah, fuck it, murder mystery. Just call it murder mystery. What is it? It's a murder mystery. Just call it that.
I'm looking forward to his next movie. Like, you know, comedy about a dad.
Yeah, dad comedy.
Dad comedy. That'd be
movie.
okay, yes, we're talking about Poetry, and you have not seen Poetry.
I've not seen Poetry. I've never seen Poetry. So we're going to definitely talk about The Farewell. We're definitely going to talk about Poetry. Yeah, we'll see about Stuber. I don't know, man. I just, every once in a while you hit man, I'm going to be traveling all day and I'm going to be tired. And do I really want to see fucking Stuber?
See, the bad news is you can't take William because it's R-rated.
That's true. Point Blank. That's the Netflix movie, but it doesn't look like getting a theatrical release.
Wait, is the character's name Point or Blank? Please tell me that's the case.
I don't know. Frank Grillo does not play Point, and Anthony Mackie does not play Blank. That would be better, though. Okay, let's move on.
I can never tell them apart. Which one's Point and which one's Blank? I always get them.
If you have a suggestion for me, for something for us to do other than me watching goddamn Stuber, let me know. GriersonLeach at gmail.com or William F. Leach at gmail.com or at GriersonLeach on Twitter. Otherwise, Grierson, have a great week. Enjoy San Francisco. Say hello to your brother for me. Hey, say hello to your mother for me. He's seeing his mom this weekend. That's why I'm saying that.
In case people are wondering what the hell. Is Mark Wahlberg closely associated with San Francisco and I didn't realize it? The answer is no.
Say hello to your mother for me.
Happy 4th. Stay safe out there, everybody. By the time you've heard this, you hopefully have stayed safe.
Yeah, hopefully everyone still has their fingers. All right. Have a great week. I will talk to you next week.
Bye.
Ball.
This shouldn't work, but it does. It only works 'cause of us. And should anyone say different, it wouldn't matter at all. This only works 'cause of us.